So much American League East bias on today's episode of Baseball Barbacast, but for good reason, as the Rays, Orioles, Blue Jays all swept, the Yankees and the Red Sox played one another. Over in Detroit, Jordan Schusterman saw Tarek Skubal weep uncontrollably in his return with the Dodgers to Comerica. Phillies sweep, Braves sweep, and then we fly through all the other results and talk about MVPCA. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows you can't spell Pete Crow Varmstrong without MVP. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. There's not an M, a V, or a P in Shohei Ohtani's name.
Yeah, and maybe that's the problem. Maybe it was that simple all along, although it obviously hasn't stopped him for several years in the past. But he's... Yeah, that's true. We have much MVP to discuss. There you go. That's good English. Later on in this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. But before we get to the latest with Ohtani and PCA, we got to give you some AL East Coast bias. That's our opener.
The world was thought for many years to revolve around the sun. And then it was revealed that the world actually revolves around the American League East, and it always freaking will. This weekend, four of the five American League East teams swept their series, and the only reason it wasn't five is because two of them, the Yankees and the Red Sox, played one another. Orioles swept the A's, Blue Jays swept the Mariners, and the Rays swept the Padres. We'll actually start in Tampa Bay. The Rays, Jordan, got their stadium. We talked about this on Friday's episode, but they had one more vote, one last hurdle they needed to leap over, and they leapt over it, and it feels like the Rays are finally going to get the yard that they have been dreaming of for a long time. And they celebrated that news by whacking the Padres around, and by that I mean edging them out barely in two games, as the Rays so often do.
I mean, this was a weird series, a big statement for the best team in the American League to welcome in a National League postseason contender. And it could have ended up being the opposite, right? Like, if the Padres went into this fringe NL postseason team and went into the trop and kicked the Rays' butt, you would have been like, oh, see, look how much better the National League is. And then the American League, the AL is such a joke. Like, this is your king, the freaking Rays, and the Padres come in there. But instead, the Rays complete their, I believe, 14th sweep of the season, which is tremendously impressive. They cruise on Friday for their 80th win of the year, and then a really close back-and-forth one on Saturday with Caminero is just cooking right now. And I don't know if we have discounted his chances at winning MVP too much, depending on how cold Yordan Alvarez finishes. At the very least, he's going to be certainly in the mix for a finalist spot, which is certainly the trajectory that he's been on since he's kind of entered our consciousness. But let's just go to Sunday, right? I mean, this ending on Sunday was as absurd of a multi-part ending that we've ever seen. The play with Samad Taylor would have been one of the crazier plays we've ever seen if Yuki Matsui had allowed the batted ball. But the fact that when Johnny DeLuca lofts this slider from Mason Miller down the left field line, and boy, is there some history in this ballpark with home runs to this exact spot. He did not hit this particularly hard, but this could have been, this was 2 outs in the bottom of the ninth with the Rays down 2, right? And DeLuca lofts one down the left field line, and Samad Taylor kind of ranges over. It's in his glove, and then his momentum takes him to that very uniquely sized wall. I'm not sure there's any other wall that's this height. There are ones that are shorter in the big leagues, and there are obviously plenty that are taller. This one is like right at neck level, maybe a little bit lower. just a tiny little section of it down the left field line at the Trop. And Samad Taylor runs into it, and his glove, right after he had it, had the ball, would have been the last out of the game to avoid the sweep. His kind of wrist goes over the fence and essentially drops the ball over the fence. And because it was kind of one motion, they rule it a home run. It goes to extras. Some more weird Padres defense in the 11th allows the Rays to walk it off. Again, Johnny DeLuca involved in the bottom of the 11th. And it was just a strange sequence. It takes a lot to score against Mason Miller. In this case, it takes a play that many people have never seen before. So this was a weird one, but credit to the Rays. They are finding ways to sweep series and a really disappointing showing for San Diego, all things considered.
The best part of this, which you've not mentioned, is that the baseball goes right into the buffet. So directly behind this outfield wall, directly behind the wall, you can see it on one of the shots, there's just plates of hamburgers. Like, the ball is closer to the hamburgers than it is to the field of play. And that's what makes a great home run.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I doubt that this feature, which is like party suite buffet line right beyond the outfield wall, I doubt that they will replicate this at their new stadium.
Maybe they will get included as
a tribute. I don't think this is something that you would want to normally have. It feels very minor league, if we're being honest. And also, it very rarely comes into play, not just because of the absurd sequence that it requires for Samad Taylor to dunk the ball into the buffet, but there's just, to hit a home run to this spot in any circumstance is already uncommon. And this was also not a home run because Samad Taylor caught the ball. I'm not saying I disagree with the ruling. You know what I'm saying.
Yes. Mason Miller has now allowed home runs in his last two outings. One of them came against Johnny DeLuca. The other one against O'Neill Cruz. That is a wonderful juxtaposition of two players. I would describe Johnny DeLuca, and I say this endearingly, as a slapdick hitter. And O'Neill Cruz is the opposite of that. He has the most raw power in the world. Baseball is a weird and wonderful sport. This was a huge weekend for the Rays as they try and keep the New York Yankees at bay. They did so successfully. They hold a 4.5 game lead over those Yanks in the American League East. Let's stay in the division and head up north, where the Toronto Blue Jays and Seattle Mariners performed a rematch of last year's American League Championship Series. If that feels impossible, because both of these teams have spent the year kind of underwhelming their way around town, well, Jake and Jordan are just as confused as the rest of you. Dylan Cease Good on Friday. On Saturday, we have an early Cal Raleigh home run. Bizardo, who is the one that gave up the big home run to George Springer in Game 7, right? He has a disaster class coming out of the bullpen in this one. Alejandro Kirk, who has been on fire for a while now, he wins it. And then on Sunday, Max Scherzer hops in the time machine and says, I'm young forever, baby. I will never get old. I'm going to pitch until my bones turn to dust. He goes 7 scoreless, 1 hit, 1 walk, 10 Ks. What in the world? He passes, I believe, Gaylord Perry for 9th on the all-time strikeout list. Congrats to Max Scherzer, who at, I think, what, how old is he now? 59,000? Continues to keep trucking. Easily his best start of the year. Asked about it after the game. They were like, hey, was this, you know, validating for you because, like, you've been through so many injuries? And he was like, no, I knew. And that is both an eye-rolling answer, because sure you did, and also insight into the type of person that Max Scherzer is. He achieves because he believes. He figures out the end of the story. And here he is, you know, effectively putting the Mariners into an even darker place than they already were in.
I have to go a little bit more on Scherzer here just because of what you just mentioned. Now, I'm jumping ahead a little bit because this will come up in my Tigers update, because I was in Detroit this weekend. Max Scherzer did indeed pass Gaylord Perry. for ninth all-time on the strikeout list.
Justin Verlander's eighth.
Not only is Justin Verlander eighth, Justin Verlander is only 19 strikeouts ahead of Max Scherzer. And whether Justin Verlander pitches again is its own conversation, which I'll get to later. But we've talked a lot about the Scherzer versus Verlander, who's going to blink first and retire. I wonder if Max has some motivation. How many starts does he have left in September? That's an interesting question in and of itself. So that now I'm really locked in 19? On the Max Scherzer strikeout total. Yeah.
19 strikeouts? This is one start against the Pirates. We'll get you there.
Very possible.
Disaster for the Mariners. I mean,
this series,
for as invigorating it was for the Blue Jays, feels more like not a death knell for the Mariners, because their schedule in September really is that easy. But they're now 9 games under 500, 5 games back of a wild card spot. Toronto, meanwhile, just 2 games under, 1.5 back of that final wild card spot. Jordan, is it time to give up on the Mariners? Is it time to unplug the TV, throw it into Puget Sound?
Playoff odds are below 20% for the first time all season. But the fact that they're even that high speaks to, I've said it on here for the last few weeks. It's hard to ignore. 17 of their last 22 games are against the 3 worst teams in baseball, the Angels, the A's, and the Rockies. So you literally can't have it easier than that. But do they deserve it? Not really. If they're playing this poorly, it doesn't matter who they're playing. They're not going to get back into this. So credit to Toronto for taking advantage. I mean, even in these earlier games, particularly in that Saturday game, to come back when the Mariners had an early lead. I mean, the Bizzardo play, it wasn't just that he came in and blew the game. That rematch with George Springer, everyone's watching like, oh God, what is going to happen here? He's facing George Springer with the bases loaded. Not only does he walk him, it's a wild pitch that scores not one run, but 2 runs, and he didn't notice the second run come around. It's a brutal look for Bizzardo. Raleigh got the ball to him in time, and he's just standing there as the second run comes in to score. That made a 3-2, and then the Jays ultimately come back. And then on Sunday, I mean, to look that bad against Max Scherzer is just, I mean, whatever. This is what this offense has looked like for much of the season. They are now last in baseball and OPS. And that is what it has looked like. The one Mariners thing before we go back to the American League East is the news that came after they got swept, which is that they are planning on calling up one of their top prospects, Lazaro Montes, their large left-handed slugger, 21 years old, one of their top prospects for the last few years. They gave him $2.5 million out of Cuba, I believe 4 years ago, and he has been one of the best power-hitting prospects in the minors. The question with him, as with a lot of prospects of this type, the contact rates are about as low as you're going to find for any real prospect. We've talked about with Murakami before he came, but after he signed, in-zone contact rate. If you're around 70%, that's basically the bottom of the league. Montes is at 65% in AAA. Now, the hard hit rates and the barrel rates are ridiculous. He is crushing the ball. He's up to almost 40 home runs in the minor leagues. He's very, very, very talented. It's just, how viable is this really at the major league level? He's going to get some homers. And I think if anything, what Seattle needs is just any semblance of positive energy, and this kid does bring it. He is a delight of a human being. Obviously a lot of fun to watch, but I mean, it reeks of desperation. We didn't think we'd see this guy until next season, and now they're saying, hey kid, come make us smile and hopefully don't strike out 45% of the time. And I hope he doesn't. I hope he hits a whole bunch of home runs against bad pitching in September and maybe helps spur some life for this offense. I'm excited to watch him, obviously. But it's just like, to press this button at this stage is, I think, says a lot.
I mean, it's different. He doesn't have the stink on him. He hasn't been around this operation all year. And so maybe he can smile and make some jokes. But Jordan, Dan Wilson's got this. Mariners manager Dan Wilson, he's got it under control. He's got it handled, everything.
Inspiring all kinds of confidence. Whew.
Oh.
Yep.
What's the opposite of the believe sign? The Mariners fans should have signs that say don't believe. Just don't believe. Quickly on the Jays before we move on to the O's. Alejandro Kirk in August.
Dude, him and Springer.
Spectacular.
Him and Springer have both been terrific for a month.
gotten it together. The Blue Jays are now 17 and 11 this month. Vlad, coming off the IL, still bad. Has not done what we thought he might do. And
still just hasn't homered at home. Back.
Still is not homered at home. Kirk and Springer have been carrying the load. The rotation has been outstanding with Cease and Scherzer, Shane Bieber. And then Spencer Miles continues to shine in this bulk role for them, which is very impressive. The Jays are a weird team. Very weird.
Yeah, I got to push back a little bit. So Cease, obviously, Cy Young for sure. Scherzer has that unbelievable start. Bieber's on the IL now. Soriano, since he came over in this weird, you know, buy and sell move, has not been awesome. He's going to start this week in Cleveland. Arrighetti, same kind of thing. And Bieber's out. The bullpen has stepped it up. Obviously, Varland's been amazing all year. Miles, you mentioned. Mason Fluharty and Braden Fisher have been outstanding for the last few weeks. So they're piecing it together. Soriano is like, well, Vlad, of course, is like the most important thing.
Yeah.
We've been talking about it. But Soriano suddenly is just this incredibly important person. I think when they traded for him, it's like, all right, he's going to be a part of their 2027 playoff push. And now it's like, hey, dude, can you help us get into the postseason this year? I know you've been on the Angels since you've been in the big leagues, and you don't really know what it's like to pitch this time of year where we're chasing a playoff spot, but we really need you. So I'm really interested in Soriano for the rest of the way, because it's not like I'm counting on Scherzer to keep doing this. So beyond Cease, I think there are still a lot of questions with that Toronto rotation, but their schedule is also notably quite easy, particularly after, not as easy as Seattle's, but there is a path there. They have six more games against the Orioles. That's a good transition to them. So Toronto, I'm excited to be around them this week and kind of see what I get a sense of how confident they're really getting to this point. So that I'm looking forward to that.
Nashville hot chicken. The Birds are hot, Jordan, sweeping the A's, the O's and the A's. A-O out in Yolo County, taking all three. I won't go beat by beat here. Couple of important points. Gunnar Henderson, huge day on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
12 total bases for you TB heads out there. Four for four, five RBI, two homers and a triple. That's huge. Colton Cowser with another home run. He's been better recently. The A's had like an all-time awful snowball fight, error fest of an inning. On Saturday, Baltimore won that one 5-3. They went 8-5 on Sunday to finish the sweep. The O's are weird. They're taking advantage of a light road trip that they're on. Three cities. They took two out of three in St. Louis. They took all three in Sacramento. And now they have three to finish it up in Colorado. Once they do that, the schedule gets tough. Red Sox, Guards, Jays, Mets, which will be the Pete Alonso homecoming. Brewers, Jays, Yankees. Okay, so the O's kind of have to rack up some wins here. They do have a lot of games left against the teams they're near. This team has yet to get seriously hot, like at any point this season. I think their longest win streak all year is, I think it's five games. And that is pretty low for a playoff team. Go ahead.
It's seven, but it was... It feels weird because that spanned the All-Star break. So they had won four going into the break, and then they swept the Astros coming out of the break. So it like felt a little disjointed. But yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, they have not really caught fire in a real way. And this road trip is that opportunity. But I think really we're going to find out is the four-game series this weekend against Boston.
Yeah. Let's finish up with Boston. The Yankees and the Red Sox played four. There was a makeup of a rainout in June, so there was a doubleheader on Sunday. It was an opportunity, though. Yankees do not mop. They win the opener. Cam Schlittler, magnificent, blowing the doors off the Red Sox. Jordan, did you know he grew up in Massachusetts, and now he's on the Yankees? Paul Goldschmidt, solo joint off of Patrick Sandoval. Amazing Bellinger's throw in the bottom of the seventh to nail Rafaela at home plate on a would-be sack fly. Bednar shuts it down. He is a fascinating character to me because he's like the nicest closer of all time. Like he's so jolly and wonderful to talk to.
Yeah.
And then it's like, hey, go be mean for 11 minutes once, you know, three times a week. And he's able to do it. Then they played two on Saturday. The Red Sox win the First of those, Jake Bennett was great. They won 6-0. And then game two starts off weird for the Yankees. Red Sox take the lead, but then Max Fried settles in. He ends up throwing just 63 pitches as he's working his way back from injury. Yankees offense kind of explodes. They win 9-2. George Laubarn Jr. kind of tweaks his knee in a weird move on a swing. He's sort of day-to-day right now. Sunday, Ranger Suarez implodes after a controversial, was it a catch, was it not a catch? The Yankees pour it on, win 16-1, big swing from Elliot Ramos. Roman Anthony and Trevor Story are the only people with extra base hits on Sunday in their first games back for the Red Sox coming off the IL. Just a quick word on the Sunday game, the discourse around the catch that was or wasn't. Like, the way that Ranger Suarez was talking about the catch after the game was very excuse-y. And the way that the Red Sox world was like, man, if, you know, they call that play right, then we wouldn't lose 16-1. It's like, well, guess what? Sometimes things don't go your way. And like, you could still get out of the inning. It's not like if there's a bad call, you have to fold immediately in the aftermath, you know? And so as someone that does not have skin in the game between the Red Sox and the Yankees, this type of thing always infuriates me. Well, you know, if this had just happened this way, it's like, okay, yeah, but then have some mental toughness after the fact.
Yep. I mean, listen, as cliche as it is, don't like it, play better, essentially applies 99.999% of the time. And this would certainly qualify here. I do think that if we are going to share our opinion on the replay, I think he probably caught it. I don't think it was definite for sure. I think you see the ball. I understand the call, too. Because there's a point where you don't see the ball. So I think he probably caught it. And yeah, tough for Rafaela, but you can't be saying, well, that's why we lost 16-1. It's a very silly thing to say out loud, but that was how the Red Sox fans were feeling. And you can understand, whatever. This is also just the context of you're frustrated. You're trying to. There's already had been some frustration in this series. The Rafaela play earlier in the series where he apparently tagged up of his own volition. He was just like, I'm going. Bellinger makes the amazing play. So kind of a weird series. I think this showed us that the Yankees are probably better than the Red Sox. Does that mean Boston can't beat them in October? No. But this series kind of went as I expected, especially in New York.
What was fun about this, though, is that it really is a preview of what we're going to see. Because odds are, at this point, with the way the standings are, these teams are playing in the wild card round. Yankees 4.5 back of the Rays in the division. Cleveland 5 back of Boston for the second wild card spot. So these two teams are pretty locked in. And now with the Yankees taking the series, building a 4-game lead, owning the season series tiebreaker advantage by winning on Sunday, it almost feels like a given we're going to have Yank Sox at the stadium during the wildcard round for the second year in a row. And so watching the series back last night, the highlights through that lens was useful. And I think my biggest takeaway is that the Yankees have a pretty definitive starting pitching advantage with the way things are set up right now. And Schlittler, and this isn't rocket science, Schlittler is the difference, right? Schlittler, who sort of announces himself to the world last October by shoving it to the Red Sox and striking out, what was it, 14, 12 in that wild card start where he goes eight innings. And it was incredible, right? He's the difference. So if the Yankees are going to roll out a rotation of Schlittler, Cole, Fried in a 3-game set, depending on Fried's health, the Red Sox are going to respond with Sonny Gray, who's having his start skipped because he's a little sleepy. He needs to get his body right. Peyton Tolley, who's good, but is a rookie. Jake Bennett, who's good, but is a rookie. And Ranger Suarez, who I trust in October, but he has not looked great recently. And so to me, that was a very clear dynamic unfolding. Now that could change. Red Sox could get some guys back. The Yankees could lose more. I mean, the Yankees pitchers are just getting hurt all the time. So who knows? Roman Anthony and Trevor Story coming back is super, super, super compelling because they missed the whole ride. The last we saw them, the Red Sox were a catastrophe. They were wallowing in the messy aftermath of Alex Cora's firing. They had yet to have any fun at all. And two of the gentlemen that played key roles in the comeback, from like a vibes perspective, Mickey Gasper and Anthony Siegler, are the ones that got sent back to AAA to make room for Trevor Story and Roman Anthony. Now, with Anthony, there's no question. He's one of the most talented hitters in the world, and you make room for that guy. He shows you why. Starts off the game on Sunday with a, you know, 101 mile an hour double down the right field line. Like, he has something that the Red Sox don't have. Story, though, I could see a world where Story's not on the playoff roster if he's not able to kind of get his stuff together by the end of the season.
Yep, I totally agree. Just going back to the pitching before we wrap up this this AL East conversation. The more you talk through it, and you alluded to it there briefly, but I'm not sure we're really harping on it enough. Ranger Suarez is the one I'm really thinking about. I mean, that was such a big part of like the selling point for this guy, is his postseason resume is immaculate. Now, it's sort of fragmented because he was kind of doing some starting, some relieving. It's not like he's got a bunch of eight inning shutout performances. But what is it, a 1.4? What is, I don't know what his ERA is in like 50 postseason innings, but it's something crazy low. And that was part of when they signed him. It wasn't because he had this unbelievably deep regular season resume. It was like, all right, Red Sox, he's the co-ace for Garrett Crochet. Now Garrett Crochet is barely even a character. Who knows if we see him again this season? And certainly not in a starting role. I don't think that's any much of a secret. So Sonny Gray's important. Peyton Tolley's fascinating. You know, I'm as high on Tolley as anybody. But to me, it, like, Ranger Suarez, and this was not exactly a vote of confidence, what you see here over the weekend. That said, we've seen throughout his career, he shows up in October and he shows up. And I bring that up because it's like, he's getting one of those starts. You are not paying him all that money for him to. He's starting over Jake Bennett. I don't care what Jake Bennett's ERA is. If he's healthy, that's what that's going to be. It's going to be Ranger Suarez. So I'm thinking a lot about him. And then you also mentioned it. It's just that we know that that matchup is almost certainly locked in. Let's just see how healthy both of these teams are by the time we get there. Obviously, Judge is part of that. Now, Roman Anthony, what's going on with the Yankees pitching? What's going on with the Red Sox pitching? What these teams actually look like once we get there is hard to say right now.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that we really know that matchup is probably coming again.
The one thing I do feel comfortable and confident projecting is that the Red Sox are going to lean heavy on left-handed pitching in any matchup, even with Crochet on the shelf, with Bennett, with Tolley, with Suarez, with Aroldis and Eric Miller in the back of the bullpen. And so that puts a lot of importance on the Yankees' right-handed bats. That means Paul Goldschmidt would be a key character in any three-game set. I think Elliot Ramos becomes a key character in any three-game set. And how the Yankees kind of orient their roster, their line, like who are they playing, right? Depending on if Judge comes back, where is Judge going to play? We got news that he is now, he's going on this road trip with the Yankees. He's been doing stuff in the outfield. He's been swinging. It's pointing towards a September return. If Judge only DHs, which is possible, he'll certainly get some DH days. If he DHs, well, are you going to play Luis Garcia Jr. at second? Because you have to play Ben Rice at first, right? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do against the lefty? Against the lefty, you have to have Paul Goldschmidt play. So if he DHs, then you're going to put Judge in the outfield, but then you don't have a spot for Elliot Ramos, who should be playing against lefties. Are you going to have him play center and bench Trent Grisham? Do you trust Ramos in center? I think there are a lot of
questions.
Play
Bellinger in center. You could play Bellinger in center.
Bellinger in center, and you would put Ramos in left. But like Ramos was awful in left. And in Yankee Stadium, left field is more important, sort of, but not really, than center field. I just think this is not an obvious solution. Like a lot of the Yankee rosters in previous seasons are like, here are the nine players. They play. You roll them out there. You bring in a couple guys late. This is like a lot more mix and matchy, and that's not necessarily something we've seen Aaron Boone have to navigate of late.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would still say that. I mean, I'm contradicting myself because we don't know what these teams are going to look like health wise. I do think the Yankees do have a pretty significant edge, really, on both sides of the ball at this stage. The way that it's trending,
I agree.
We saw versions of that this weekend. But it's not, that doesn't guarantee anything in a three-game series, and we will see how that goes. All right, so just to really set the stage here and why we really leaned into the AL East, and then we'll take a break. I think what really stood out to me and why I wanted to mention this at this point is just the reality that we could very plausibly have four AL East postseason teams. With the Jays and Orioles just a game behind, a game, game and a half behind Cleveland, as I just, we mentioned, Toronto is about to play in Cleveland this week. The Orioles are about to play at the Rockies. Long way to go after that. There's a scenario where by the end of this week, the American League East accounts for, I believe, five of the top seven records in the American League. Now, of course, some of these teams like Toronto and Baltimore aren't actually that good. So it's not like I'm saying these are five juggernauts. But it is amazing in this year where it has, we've kind of now come back around to the general, not cliche, notion that the American League East is infinitely better than these other divisions. Is this could be, standings-wise, one of the more extreme versions that we've seen of that in recent history. And if they get those four postseason teams, there's a real path for it. So a lot of work left for these teams to go. Sometime they're going to beat up on each other. Those six games left between Toronto and Baltimore is certainly going to be important there. But the Rays are in good shape. Only four games left against the Yankees. They've built this nice lead. And as we mentioned, yeah, Boston and New York, it's really, really trending towards that. So yeah. I'm just so interested of the September storylines. It's do we end up with four AL East postseason teams? Because at this point, it's hard to ignore it as a very, very real possibility.
Something to keep in mind is that Tampa Bay is west of Cleveland. So in that way, you could have them win the AL Central. Just something to think about.
Okay. All right. We'll let the commissioner's office know. We're going to take a break. When we return, Tarek Skubal pitched against the Tigers? Oh, my goodness. All right. We'll get to that when we come back on Baseball Barbcast.
Yeah, my friend Jordan was there.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbcast. I was in Detroit, Michigan over the weekend. It's time for a field report. All righty. Here we go. The Dodgers are in town in Detroit. As AJ Hinch very relatably laid out before Friday's game, he's kind of recounting what the last few months have been like for the Tigers. And then he said, and then you look at the schedule and there's this little weekend in August and the Dodgers are coming to town and you're counting out the days. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What's going to happen if they push it back? What's going to happen? And here we are facing Tarek Skubal on a Friday night. What a scene this was. This was cool to be able to go cover. You know, I've covered Skubal a good amount over the last few years. Of course, I've covered the Dodgers. To watch, I mean, there's so many layers to this, right? There's just the Skubal and Detroit relationship of it all. There's also just watching Skubal exist. We've watched all these stars become Dodgers and see how they adjust to their new realities. Some of them have immediately fit in and become very comfortable. Some of them are Kyle Tucker. And so Tarek Skubal is like an interesting one in between because he has this such intense relationship with the city of Detroit and that organization, but it was a very strange last year with them. And that doesn't take anything away from what he means to the fans and there, but there's also part of him that you can tell is pretty fired up to be a Dodger and is comfortable to show up and be like, I'm an alpha, just like all the other alphas in this room. I'm ready to go out and pitch against the Tigers. And once he got over the tears during the video tribute as he was walking in from the bullpen, which, by the way, let's just pause here because we speculated on the timing of that and how that was going to work. Skubal admitted, before I get your take on this, I just want you to know the context here. Skubal said that they had told him that it was going to be at 6:27 and it ended up being at 6:37. So he was clearly fine. I mean, he said he was going to probably cry either way. I'm just giving you because we discussed the logistics of it and what we when we thought sure. we would do it, when you would do it, if they were trying to rattle him, if they were trying to honor him. The point is that it ended up happening as he was walking in from the bullpen, which ended up being kind of nice because it was a natural moment for the crowd to kind of rise up and salute him, and he was able to watch it. It wasn't while he was pitching, it was a little weird, but I think it ended up being okay.
I think that's fine because he's throwing the bottom half of the inning. And so he's coming in from the bullpen and he can cry as much as he wants. And, you know, he has 10 minutes while the Dodgers are hitting to sort of collect himself. I love, as King let the kids cry, Jake Mintz. Tarek Skubal talking about his feelings. Hell yeah.
Nicely done.
This
love to see it
is good stuff. Good masculinity for Tarek Skubal, who is both like in your face, dog, alpha, blowing it past you. I'm the best in the business. And yeah, I'm going to cry because I lived here for a long time and I love this place and it means a lot to me and I'm back. That dichotomy is so important. Really, like being able to hold those two things in your head at the same time, that like this is an emotional experience and I'm going to show that. And then once I got on the bump, I'm able to compartmentalize and strike out all my old friends.
And that is pretty much exactly what happened after after they got the pitch comm sorted, which was very amusing. I don't know how many times that's happened for the first pitch of his game at Comerica Park, but that was very funny. So that provided a nice little laugh. And then after Gleyber Torres hit a double, I believe he retired the next 15 in a row. The changeup was just, I mean, not that it's a secret that Tarek Skubal's got a good changeup, but that usage has ticked up even more since he's been with the Dodgers. I think a few starts ago, he threw the most changeups he's ever had in a single outing. So we'll see how much he continues to lean on that. Towards the later part of the outing, it was not as much changeups, and Max Clark tagged him for a triple that gave the Tigers the lead. So that was a really fun moment. Skubal gets pulled after 83 pitches, which was notable because he had gone over 100 in his previous two outings. And it was like, man, Dodgers are really riding him. Dave Roberts basically said after the game, like, yeah, that was predetermined. We're trying to go for the long, you know, think about the long haul here. We're playing for something bigger where the Dodgers, we're not trying, we don't need him to go out and have a messy seventh inning. And then, you know, we're the Skubal outing that we were looking for, which he essentially gave them, you know, ends up getting a little messier. So they were able to kind of get away with that. Skubal looked like himself. He was throwing hard. Changeup was great. And then the Dodgers kind of eked out the win.
What was your sense of the Scoob Boo cheer pie chart?
Yeah. So when he was walking in, I think it was pretty overwhelmingly positive with the Scoob, you know, and Skubal had a quote about that too, which was funny. I will say when he went out to the mound for the first, it wasn't like the whole stadium was booing. I noticed more of like, it felt like a switch of like, all right, now you're on the Dodgers and
booing the Dodgers defense? They were like booing Miggy Rowe.
Very possible. Well, Miggy Rowe doesn't deserve the blame, but yeah, I think that an alternate reality I am wondering is if this whole thing was happening and he was just on the Brewers, like, would they even bother? Like, I do wonder how much of it is just like everybody wants to boo the Dodgers anyway, and so it
like
just
the Dodgers are in town for three games, and you get to boo as much as you want and feel fine.
That's the thing.
And Tarek Skubal happens to be there too.
Yeah, so I just feel like if he was on the Brewers or the Rays or the Braves, like I don't think it would be any amount of booing, honestly. That said, you know, the Dodgers eke out a win on Friday in their fifth straight one-run game, or I guess fourth straight, and then their fifth straight comes on Saturday where Blake Snell was good. It was pretty messy, but it was still Blake Snell. Like, he's a pretty, especially, we'll get to our Ohtani update. Blake Snell and Tyler Glasnow, who also look great on Sunday, these guys are some of the best pitchers in baseball. And they've become side characters because of what the Dodgers operation is, but they are amazing as well, and they are going to be quite important in October. But the Tigers win on Saturday. Kevin McGonigal walk-off ground rule double, which I guess he only gets credit for bases loaded, ground rule double, only gets credit for the one run, which is unfortunate for him. But so the Tigers walk it off then because the Dodgers offense is just stuck in the mud. There's just not a lot going on, not a lot of consistency, not a lot of fluidity, not a lot of pass on the bat. They sort of break out on Sunday against Fromber, but not really. Relative to recently, it certainly seemed like it. They win 6-1. Glasnow was great. Teoscar homers. That was good to see. But Dodgers offense has still been pretty tough to watch. Otani has really not looked very good recently. Mookie's still pretty meek offensive contributor. Freddie is racking up hits. He hasn't homered in almost 2 months. His power is just non-existent. It's hard to complain about him because he is hitting like 310 over the last little bit, but he doesn't look like this like fearsome power bat at all. And they're just kind of waiting for some of these other guys to get going. So, of course, the big news with the Dodgers over the weekend is that Otani did not pitch as he was maybe going to. We can talk about that here in a second, but even from afar, what else do you take away from this Dodgers-Tigers series? Then I'll do a quick Tigers before we go back to Otani.
I just remain worried about the Dodgers' ability to hit left-handed pitching at an elite level. Hmm. They rank 13th in baseball in OPS for like their righty hitters against lefties. They rank higher than that if you just do lefties, because I don't know if you heard, but they have Shohei Ohtani and Freddie Freeman. And Max Muncy, who's solid against lefties. Them against the Phillies in a 3-game set would worry me. Again, they'll probably win. I'm hedging. But the lefties that the Phillies can roll out there against the Dodgers will keep those games close like they were last year, right? And without Pajes, that makes it harder. Without Pajes at full strength come October, that makes it even harder. To me, the lineup is the biggest concern for this group right now. The starting pitching is as good as it's ever been, even without Shohei Ohtani trending towards a return.
Quick Tigers, couple Tigers things, because we're close to moving them to the side. Yeah.
One last Dodgers Ohtani point.
We're coming back to him.
Year.
But yeah.
Last year they won the World Series last year because of the rotation, right? Like,
yeah.
Every day they were sending out a world beater and they were showing up and performing. This is going to be an upgrade. Okay? If you take Ohtani out of that group from last year and you put in Scooble, that's better. Scooble is better at pitching than Ohtani. That's a fact. Okay. Mm-hmm. Ohtani was great at points on the mound in October. Scooble is better. Now, what is the difference between last year's Snell Glasnow versus this year's Snell Glasnow is a huge question. But in terms of trading out Ohtani for Scooble, it's kind of a no-brainer. At this point, Ohtani, in my opinion, should just go hit for the rest of the year. Like, you can go pitch next year, that's fine. But where his body's at right now and the way he's been hitting, which has been just okay, just they got arms.
And that was, I think, the most interesting thing that Dave Roberts said over the weekend was he, and I'd have to pull up the quotes. I'm sure we'll end up writing about this at some point this month, leading up to October, as we continue to just have no clarity on when he's going to pitch again. But Dave Roberts, when kind of pushed on it, pretty much admitted, said out loud, like, yeah, his bat's more important to us than his arm. Like, the way that our roster is right now, we need his bat. And that's why he remains in the lineup even as he's battling these things, right? Because they're trying to get him going offensively. He's also reiterated that Ohtani at no point has said that his knee or his bicep is bothering him when he's hitting. And that's fine. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. But that speaks to the fact, and he said, if it was, then we would also consider giving him a day off there, but we can't. And part of that is because their offense has been so inconsistent that they don't want to take Ohtani out of the lineup. So I agree with you. I think there are a lot of people that agree with you at this point. And as how it relates to MVP, we're going to get to PCA in a second, but yeah, I think your point about just the state of the Dodgers pitching in general. And as we keep saying with all these teams, let's see how healthy all these guys are once we get to the end of the month. But I agree with you. They are in a very, very interesting point. The one Tigers thing I just want to say before we move on, just being around that team and just kind of watching and trying to understand, all right, like why has – we've mentioned they've been dealing with some of the injuries, like Riley Green's been out, Kerry Carpenter's been out. Dylan Dingler, who about 3.5 weeks ago, we were like, is this guy going to be an MVP finalist? He had a monster series in Seattle where he had multiple hits in all three games and homered in all three games. And Jack Flaherty tweeted, Ding belongs in a certain conversation.
Like, all right. Which conversation?
MVP, right? Hey, MVP. Let's take him seriously.
Is he running?
Other smart people.
2028?
Other smart people.
Democratic presidential nominee? Not old enough.
Belongs in a certain conversation. Since Jack Flaherty tweeted that Dylan Dingler belongs in a certain conversation, negative 12 WRC plus.
Oh, no.
He's hitting 105 over his last 20 games. And that's not great. So in this Tigers lineup that has been leaning on him so much for a lot of the season, even when they were healthier, that kind of speaks to how some of their run production has really fallen off recently, is that Dylan Dingler, who is awesome and one of the best catchers in baseball, I would love to have him on my team. He is going through it right now. And that is a big part of why they have essentially fallen out of relevance at all. Their playoff odds are now sub 5%. And now they're going to kind of play out the string and see what they have. See what you got with Max Clark and see if Kevin McGonigal can definitely win Rookie of the Year. Yeah.
What do we have here?
Yeah. What do we have
here? See what we got for 2027.
So Dylan Dingler will get MVP votes still, but now McGonigal might finish ahead of him now with the way things are trending, if we're being honest. Maybe that's a little bit crazy. All right. Let's we're talking about MVP. Who's that guy? MVP PCA. PCA, let's do that. Let's go around the league.
On the Sunday Night Baseball broadcast, Joey Votto was asked about the MVP race. And he said, 100%, it is and it will be Pete Crow Armstrong. And then after Joey Votto said that, PCA actually hit another home run in the ninth inning in what was a loss for the Cubs. The Cubs did lose this series over the weekend to the Reds, dropping 2 out of 3 at home. That's not what I'll remember. I'll remember Pete Crow Armstrong's first 3 home run game with Sammy Sosa in the building. This, for a Cubs fan, was enough for tears, for happy tears. The way that PCA is commanding his at-bats right now, the way that his plate appearances are flowing, he is looking and acting dangerous in a way that he wasn't, even at the beginning of the season. The best hitters on the planet look dangerous. They are fearsome. They inspire a different type of approach from the pitcher, where the pitcher's like, oh, don't mess up. Don't mess up. Don't mess up. Don't throw this high fastball into the zone. Oh, now it's a souvenir. He did it 3 times on Saturday, 2 more times on Sunday, and he is stretching that gap past Shohei Ohtani for the NL MVP.
Yeah, and I mean, the timing of Saturday was really remarkable. We go in for post-game after the Dodgers get walked off, and after we ask about how their offense stinks, it's like, hey, so is Ohtani going to pitch tomorrow? Because he still had not confirmed all the way to that point. Dave Roberts says, yeah, Ohtani's not pitching tomorrow. We literally walk out. We look at our phone. Oh, PCA hit his 3rd home run. It was like at the exact same time. And that just felt like, that is what I remember. If PCA goes on to win the MVP, either unanimously or 28 of 20, not 30 votes, whatever it is, we said a few weeks ago, like, man, like, could he get to 40-40? I think he's going to get to 40-40. He's at 38 home runs now, and I think he's at 32 steals. So some work to do on the bases, but it's not like he's not fast enough. I think he's going to pull an Ohtani, and he's going to make sure he gets to 40-40 the way that Ohtani made sure he got to 50-50. He might end up, if he stays this out, he's going to be closer to 50-50 than he was 40-40 if he can really start running.
Yeah.
So I agree. I think that I know I've been on here being downplaying it and being the last Ohtani defender. At this point, we're not expecting him to pitch any more soon. I maintain that I will always be more impressed with Ohtani because it's just the most amazing thing I've ever seen, that he's one of the best pitchers and one of the best hitters. But if we're just talking value and what you provided and what you've accomplished this season,
yeah,
at this point, it's not close. It isn't close. PCA is almost at 10 war and it's still not September. I mean, he's so far ahead of everybody else, the base running, the defense. So yeah, at this point, I'm conceding that it'd be hard for PCA to not win.
The conversation has changed fundamentally. For a while, it was Ohtani and PCA are comparable hitters. How do we value the other things they do? Is Ohtani's pitching better, more valuable than PCA's defense and base running? That's not the conversation anymore because PCA has been, if the season ended today, a definitively better hitter and a far better offensive player when you take the base running into account than Shohei Ohtani. And then you can talk about the defense and the pitching and all that stuff. But just as an offensive producer among qualified players, PCA leads the NL in WRC plus and OPS plus. He has been the best qualified hitter in the National League. Full stop. He also happens to be the most valuable defensive player, maybe of all time. Not that
well. I wouldn't. Not that hard. I'm not going that far. But the point is
one of the most valuable defensive players in the history of the sport. Like he is as good at this thing, which is playing center field, as anybody really has ever been in the modern era. And I think that those two things combined make him the undeniable selection. He would have to either get injured or hit a massive cold streak in order to lose it at this point, especially now that Ohtani's not coming back on the mound. One dynamic to keep in mind, actually two dynamics. One, PCA getting really cold, totally possible. We've seen it before. However, because he doesn't chase like he used to, I think it's harder for him to go fully icy cold than he could in previous seasons. The second thing to keep in mind is that if Ohtani gives up the ghost and stops trying to pitch, could we see him lock back in at the plate? Again, we're talking about Ohtani here, right? Like this dude could have one more burst in him and no one would be shocked. And I hope he does. I want to have one more conversation where it's like, is Ohtani making it a race again? I don't think that will happen.
I agree.
But don't be shocked if it does.
Yeah, and again, the Dodgers also have a pretty easy schedule. He could start beating up on some bad pitching here at some point. But I agree. I think PCA has got it locked in. You talk about the conversation changing. Yeah, now the conversation is this the greatest Cubs season of all time? Yes, I know Sammy Sosa once hit 64 home runs. But if you're looking at WAR, you're looking at the overall thing, we're basically talking about, okay, the record for WAR in a season is Rogers Hornsby in 1929, which is one of the weird parts about his career because he did all that stuff with the Cardinals and then won that one more MVP in 1929. But it's Ernie Banks and it's Ron Santo and Sammy Sosa and a bunch of those seasons. And there's Hack Wilson and Ryan Sandberg in there. And now it's PCA. He's got a whole month left to push his WAR even higher. I mean, it's already one of the 10 greatest seasons in Cubs history. And how much higher he can climb there for that franchise is something that I'm also quite compelled by. So, yeah.
The Sammy Sosa 2001 season is incredible because he has an 1174 OPS and doesn't win MVP because Barry Bonds hits 73 home runs. And I also love that Sammy Sosa steals zero bases this season. Zero. He didn't even he got thrown out twice. He didn't have a single steal a couple of years after stealing 34. He stole, 22 in 97. He's like, nah, I just do this. I just hit home runs. 425 total bases that year.
Yeah. PCA now over 300 total bases, though, which y'all know we care about that.
TB.
Otherwise, other things from this series, Sal Stewart homered in all three games. The NL rookie conversation is going to be very interesting down the stretch. J.J. Weatherholt placed on the injured list. Nolan McClain, Carson Bench also still part of that conversation. But Sal Stewart, I'm excited to talk more about him as the season winds down. The Reds, of course, are not good, but they win this series. And now, because the Cubs lose a series, they're 8 games back of Milwaukee, which is unfortunate because if it were closer, the seven of the next 10 games being against the Brewers would be super juicy. And instead, it's kind of just like, all right, make a statement. But in the standings, it doesn't really matter.
Do you know who the top five hitters are in RBI in baseball? This is just like so funny.
Well, right. I mean, I know Sal Stewart's number one, and I think I saw that Alec Burleson is number two.
Sal Stewart is number one. Alec Burleson, number two. Jordan Walker, Jordan Alvarez, CJ Abrams, number five. Just a phenomenal top five list. I love RBI. Wow. Okay, let's take a break, Jordan. When we get back, we'll talk about the Philadelphia Phillies, who are now tied with those Chicago Cubs in the wild card race. Chat about the Braves. They swept the Rockies and fly through all the other series from the week. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go fast.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Philadelphia Phillies sweep the Angels over the weekend, taking all three games against the Halos out in Anaheim. Game one of this series was silly town, crazy times. Wade Mecklar with a ludicrous catch in the bottom of the ninth with runners on to save the game for the Angels until the game was not saved as Edmundo Sosa clocked a grand slam to flip the score. Two batters later, Phillies win again on Saturday and Sunday to complete the sweep. Zach Wheeler looks significantly better on Sunday, going six innings, allowing just one run. Christopher Sanchez, predictably brilliant on Saturday. Seven innings, eight Ks, no runs for him. The Phillies are now tied with the Chicago Cubs atop the NL wild card race. They have the same record. The Cubs hold the season series over the Phillies, so they have the four seed, with the Phillies having the five right now. But this gap has certainly closed.
Yes. Five games back of Atlanta. So, I mean, the Phillies-Cubs, is that quite on the level of this is definitely what we're going to get as Red Sox-Yankees? Not quite yet, because the Diamondbacks and Padres are at least on the periphery and are good enough to play their way into the conversation. But the fact that that could be that like who's hosting that series could change at the very end is compelling, right? If it does become obvious that it's going to be Phillies Cubs in that wildcard series, that is going to be very compelling. As for Atlanta, let's go to them here. And then I will ask you a question about my power rankings this week, because the Braves, they take care of business by sweeping the Colorado Rockies. They have won seven games in a row. They have the same record as the Dodgers. That is, of course, what they are focused on, not just fending off the Phillies, but trying to get one of those top two seeds. They, of course, clinched the tiebreaker over the Dodgers last week. Now they take care of business against the Rockies. Michael Harris had a big weekend. Acuna finally getting some hits. And then Matt Olson, who's been doing it for them all season, has the walk-off on Sunday. Sean Murphy is also back. He started to put together some good swings. How they work him into the lineup with Drake Baldwin still being the main catcher is interesting. The Braves pitching, I'm still not feeling awesome about beyond Chris Sale. We'll talk about more of that coming as October approaches. I guess my question is, like, the Braves, because of their record, I think I'm still going to have them ahead of the Dodgers, obviously, just because of what they just did last week. I'm curious how you would stack up, first of all, Phillies versus Cubs, and then where the Yankees fit into that conversation.
Sure.
That is I'm shuffling right now on my power rankings.
Phillies-Cubs, I think that along the lines of power ranking ideology, power ranking theology, you have to rank the Phillies above the Cubs, because they have the same record and the Phillies are hotter. Is that not power ranking?
Right. Once now that the head-to-head feels like long enough ago, right? The Cubs taking six of their seven games against the Phillies doesn't feel, it's not the same team. So I agree with you. I think I feel comfortable having the Phillies ahead of the Cubs, even though they have the same record and the Cubs have been ahead of them in the standings for a while. Would you with the Yankees over both of them, over neither of them? Like, what do we think? I might just put them right in between them. Oh, you think over both? Okay.
I'd go over both. Just so you know, the the outfield. Oh my God. Felix Reyes hit fourth.
Yes, I remember that.
The
well.
Last time that the Phillies and okay. the Cubs played. All right. It has been
that sums it up.
A while. That's all. I would put the Yankees above both of these teams right now. I think they have a higher ceiling. I think they have an easier path to the World Series, obviously.
Hmm.
And with Judge, I think taking all three out of four from the Red Sox is sort of a definitive loud statement series.
Sure.
More impressive than the Phillies beating the worst team in the league in Anaheim.
Fair enough. All right. Let's keep it moving and go to another interesting interleague matchup. That's the Houston Astros taking two out of three in Queens over the New York Mets. They win a close one on Friday. Juan Soto comes back on Saturday. Hey, Juan Soto, good to see you again. Wasn't sure if you were definitely going to come back and play for the Mets, but we've talked about how much fun it looks to be to play for the post-deadline Mets. Maybe Juan Soto wanted in there. He comes back. Homers on Sunday. Mets win on Saturday. But the real story here is that the Astros just went into New York and won series over the Yankees and the Mets. They are in first place over the in the awful American League West. And what that's really worth, who's to say? But they're one game over 500. They've got that run differential all the way up to minus 43. Good for them. And now this week, I'm calling it the series of the week, four games against the White Sox, who they are still several games behind. But if they want to make a push for getting a bye, then this is pretty much your chance to get a mix up of some ground on the White Sox.
I love the idea that the two wild card series could be Yankees, Red Sox, and then two under 500 teams, mm-hmm. Astros, Guardians. mm-hmm. Like the Delta in sauce play. Level. Oh,
that is in play, if not, frankly, just straight up likely.
Hey, Jordan, who is good on?
Oh, yeah.
Well, one second. Who is pretty good on Friday? I believe Nolan McLean had a nice outing on Friday and is making
on Saturday,
some noise in the Rookie of the Year race. Never wrong, just early. Jake Mintz, Nolan McLean.
Yeah, I mean, Jake's acting like he called Zach Thornton to win Rookie of the Year.
I invented
Nolan McLean.
Nolan McLean. I invented him.
he's gonna have a chance here. If Weatherholt does not play the rest of the year, McLean versus all of Sal Stewart's RBIs is going to be very interesting. All right, so let's keep it moving. We just mentioned Houston about to welcome the Chicago White Sox to town for four games. Those White Sox beat the Minnesota Twins in two out of three over the weekend. Couldn't quite get the sweep on Sunday, but we got Andrew Benintendi with a big home run. We got Colson Montgomery, 28th homer of the year. He has a billion strikeouts, but you got a shortstop with that many homers. That's still pretty good. And let's see it, White Sox. This is now we're really in crunch time here. I like their chances to make the postseason. I think their playoff odds now have to be 86%. So it seems like we are going to see the White Sox in October, just 2 years after losing 200 games. But can they lock down this division? Can they make it happen? They still have a decent little cushion. I'm just so interested in it. Twins starting to fade away. Their playoff odds now down to 5%. So probably won't be talking much more about them this season as much as I am going to enjoy watching Walker Jenkins and Kayla Culpepper. So that's the Chicago White Sox. Anything on them before we keep it in the AL Central?
Colson Montgomery is at 184 strikeouts this season. That leads baseball. We had a situation like this last year where James Wood was making a run at the all-time single season strikeout record. That is 223, held by Mark Reynolds in 2009. That record is incredible considering it was in the era preceding this one. Like we weren't doing strikeouts then like we were doing strikeouts now.
Not to this degree, yeah.
Mark Reynolds was, but not the rest of us. Colson Montgomery's got a chance here. 184 strikeouts. And the thing is, unlike James Wood last year, when the Nats like gave him days off so he wouldn't break that record, Colson Montgomery is going to keep playing because the White Sox are in the playoffs and are going to be in the playoffs. So like this is in play. He needs 39 more strikeouts to tie the all-time record. Do they raise a banner? Stay tuned. Brewers, or excuse me, let's stay in this division. Royals taking 2 out of 3 over the Guards. I need, on the off day before the playoffs start, I want Royals Mets in the post-deadline having a great time bowl. Like, play that thing in Cancun. Stream it on Tubi. I'm these two teams are having a ball. A ball and a half.
Yeah.
Michael Wacha, 8 scoreless on Friday. Big late offensive surge for the Royals on Saturday. Guards explode offensively on Sunday. Cleveland probably should win this series, but I guess the post-deadline Royals are just a wagon.
Guards have been sneaky poopy at home. They have one of the worst home records in baseball. They are 32-36. Tied with the Reds for the 6th worst home record in baseball. We will see how that manifests this week against Toronto. Let's go to the Brewers and Rangers. Okay, Brewers. They're a good baseball team, and they looked like it on Friday and Saturday. Logan Henderson, he is terrific. Jake Bowers reaches base 5 times. We love to see that. Brewers win 6-1. Jackson Churio goes deep on Saturday. So does William Contreras. Brewers win on that one. Rangers avoid the sweep on Sunday. Dustin May has not been awesome for the Brewers. He has not been as good as Tarek Skubal. So if we were wondering how that, you know, if he could be like, however, well, you know, they didn't get Tarek Skubal, but they got Dustin May. But Logan Henderson.
Henderson, the guy who the Brewers would have had to give up for Tarek Skubal, has been better than Tarek Skubal since they didn't train him for Tarek Skubal. 2.23 ERA over his last 5 starts, including 7 innings of 1-run ball against the Rangers this weekend. 7 punchies for him. He is a crucial character for the Brewers. He's going to start game 2 of a playoff series. Like, after the miss, it will be Logan Henderson.
Yes.
In my opinion.
And
he's been that
who
good.
Who is going to start game 3?
Pirates taking 2 out of 3 this weekend over the Cardinals. We won't get lost in the sauce here. Joshua Baez hit his 5th home run. He has 9 hits, 5 homers. That ratio is in line with his skill set. Sunday, Esmerlin Valdez with the 16th home run of the year. Mason Montgomery out of the pen for the Pirates has been unbelievable. The Pirates and the Cardinals just... neither of them are particularly relevant characters for the remainder of the season. One team that is a relevant character for the remainder of the season, the Arizona Diamondbacks. They split a 4-game set with the Giants over the weekend. Very weird Thursday, Friday, doubleheader Saturday, because the Giants have a makeup game on Monday in Atlanta before going to Pittsburgh on Tuesday. Very weird. The Giants looked okay in this one. Bryce Eldridge 4-for-5 on Sunday with 4 RBIs. The Diamondbacks should win 3 of these games. But what's important about the Diamondbacks, Jordan, it seems like Ketel Marte is going to be back today. Ketel Marte, renowned second baseman, represented by Charisse Espinoza Dash. His IL stint is up. And... that means he can play for the Diamondbacks today. He'll certainly do that and apologize today, right?
Listen, the reporting from Ken Rosenthal, clearly Diamondbacks teammates are not happy with him. However, GM Mike Hazen summed it up. I believe his quote was, "We're in the business of winning baseball games. And if the Philadelphia Phillies are coming to town and Ketel Marte is eligible to play, he's going to play." So... maybe at the end of the week, if things are going bad, he's just going to not show up and take his ass to the casino again. But if not, you know, it's also very much possible. He homers 3 times and the D-backs take the series over the Phillies. And suddenly we're talking about them catching the Phillies. And we're like, oh, my God, the stakes are good. Ketel Marte is one of the best players in baseball. That is also in play. And that is why he is going to be activated and be in the lineup this week. So
the reason the sport is
strange,
silly.
But yeah,
the reason the sport is silly is because if he homers 3 times this weekend, his teammates won't be mad at him anymore. This is how it works.
So funny. All right. One more series. It's not yet complete. That's a 4-game set between the Marlins and Nationals. They play again
today. You
want to
do this?
They play again today.
They play again today.
No, we don't have to do this. They don't have to do this. I will say that the Marlins are still over 500. 4% playoff odds. So... they're at least going to hang around. Do they play any of the other teams in front of them anymore this season? I guess that would be the only other thing I would check. We don't have to talk about what actually happened in that series. They got the Royals, Cubs, Mets, Dodgers, D-backs, Padres. Okay. They got a road trip to Arizona and San Diego in the middle of the month. So if they're still alive by then, those games could maybe mean something. All righty. We are done talking about the weekend. We will tease the fact that we got something fun coming up at the end of this week.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Very something we've never done before. This is like a new thing. That's all I can say. But we are very, very excited. More details on that coming this week. Hopefully that was sufficiently vague. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing this episode of Baseball Barbecast. You can email us at baseballbarbecast@gmail.com. And we will talk to you all on Wednesday. Thanks, y'all.